Welcome, Outposters. Well, we got a special treat for you here today. With us is author Martin Turnbull. Did I pronounce it correctly, sir?
Yes, it is.
All right. And he has several series of books that really detail a kind of a combination of fiction and real life in the, I would call it the golden age of Hollywood. And I think he starts pretty much in the 20s. He works his way up all the way through, it looks like the 70s, if I saw the timelines correctly. And and we also have Ben with us, and Ben, you know, does all of our great Hollywood history articles. So Ben was really excited to get you to reach out to him.
Oh.
So tell us about, well, you know what, Ben, I'm going to let you take over the questions because I know you're just itching.
All right. So tell us about the Garden of Allah. Maybe people don't know what that is. Could you just sort of tell us what that place was a little bit?
So the Garden of Allah was a hotel that opened in 1927. But before that, it was the home to a silent movie star. She was this great dramatic Russian actress called Alla Nazimova. She was a great big dramatic stage actress who was lured to Hollywood with an enormous paycheck from Metro Pictures. Came to Hollywood, found this house, turned it into a big movie star mansion, and proceeded to take Hollywood by storm. And then she didn't manage her finances terribly well, because these people were very good at earning a lot of money, not great on holding on to that money. So by the mid-20s, she found herself in financial straits. Her big main asset was this house on Sunset Boulevard, right at the gateway of the Sunset Strip. Somebody came to her and said, you know what? This house of yours with this enormous 2-acre backyard, you could turn that into a hotel and you'd have this cash flow just in case this career of yours, which seems to be sputtering, dies. And that was a good idea. So she was on tour at the time. She gave most of her money to these people and they turned it into a hotel. And that hotel opened in January 27, and it was an instant success because Alla Nazimova was sort of the Gertrude Stein of Hollywood in that she held these salons, these Saturday night salons, where she gathered intellectuals and academics and cultured people and European emigres to discuss lofty things like sculpture and art and history and letters. And so it became known as an interesting place where interesting people gather to talk about interesting things. So when it became a hotel, it continued to attract those people who knew of its reputation. So that was January 27th. And over the next 32 years, it gathered a clientele of creative and ambitious people who came to Hollywood to see if they could make their mark. Unknown, such as say Ginger Rogers or Errol Flynn, or some of them known, like Robert Benchley or Dorothy Parker from the Algonquin Round Table, who'd been lured to Hollywood, like Nazimova had, to write for the movies. So these were actors, writers, directors, designers, who came to stay at this hotel, which was a residential hotel. It wasn't like we check into the Days Inn for a night and then check out. These people sure. would get a contract, like Scott Fitzgerald got a contract for 10 weeks at MGM. He moved in there and stayed there because these weren't just hotel rooms, these were apartments. These were self-contained apartments. So when you're there for 3 months, it's different from when you were there just one night. You look out your window and there's Errol Flynn and David Niven talking to Ginger Rogers. And they're having a cocktail party. Well, you're going to invite yourself over, aren't you? Especially if you're Humphrey Bogart, and you find that there is this constant hubbub of people checking in and checking out, making their mark, trying to make their mark, having made their mark, checking out again. So the Garden of Allah, fairly quickly, I would say, gained a reputation as being the place, an in place for very interesting people, ambitious to do very big things. And so I got this reputation of being a very special, a very special place during a very special time, because as the Garden of Allah got going in 27, a couple of months before the Jazz Singer opened, the Jazz Singer, of course, being the movie that ushered the talkies,
right?
So it paralleled the golden years of Hollywood. So as Hollywood got talkies, then invented Technicolor, then invented the blockbuster with Gone with the Wind and Citizen Kane, and then as Hollywood evolved into a propaganda machine during World War II, then after World War II came the Red Scare, and after the Red Scare came television, and after television came widescreen and stereophonic and 3D and all the things that came with it. The Garden of Allah was there, 27. It closed in 59, which was the last gasp of the studio era, with, say, you know, Some Like It Hot and Ben Hur. And then it closed in the summer of 59. So I thought, wait a minute, this hotel was open from the Jazz Singer to Ben Hur. That's the golden era of Hollywood. Yeah. What if I could write a series of novels that told the history of that ongoing evolution of the golden years of Hollywood, what we now think of as the golden years of Hollywood? I could tell that story through the eyes of the people who lived and played at the Garden, because those people were acting in them, writing them, directing them, lighting them. That seemed like a very, very commercial and very self-contained idea. And as soon as I had that idea, I was off to the races. I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
Now, did you see I think the character that I read was Adler. And again, I only read, like, on your website, kind of the first page. But is he just like kind of an everyman? Like, I'm thinking kind of like Almost Famous, you know, the guy that was more of a fly on the wall to all these other people that were there. For people who may want to read, I mean, describe kind of the characters.
Okay. So this story is actually three characters. So you've got Marcus Adler, who wants to be a screenwriter. So he wants to work behind the camera. Then I've got Gwendolyn Brick, who is an aspiring actress. She's from the other Hollywood. She's from Hollywood, Florida, who comes to Hollywood, California. So she wants to work in front of the camera. And the third person I have is Catherine. Catherine Massey wants to be a journalist, ends up becoming a gossip columnist with the Hollywood Reporter. So I figured, because so much happened during this era and so much change went on, every couple of years something happened that changed the game, that I couldn't have one person watching everything. That would be a bit unrealistic. Did you have a question, Ben?
Oh, I was just gonna jump in when you were done talking. I had some things to say.
Okay, so
I was just motioning to let him know.
Well, when I stopped talking. Okay. I had three characters that between the three of them could reasonably and conceivably be in interesting places when interesting things happened and the game of Hollywood changed or fell apart or found its new footing. And so we follow their lives through the nine books as they evolve as people, their careers evolve, their relationships evolve, while staying at the Garden of Allah, hanging around with people who also were real people, actual people, who were Tallulah Bankhead, who was, you know, Rachmaninoff, who was Harpo Marx, who was Lauren Bacall, because they all stayed there. So I felt my three fictional characters could interplay with factual people who really were there at that time. Yeah.
So, I've read the whole first book. It's called The Garden on Sunset. Uh-huh. And my favorite character of the three, I like Gwendolyn the best. I thought she was a lot of fun.
Yeah. She's emerged as the crowd pleaser. I can't choose between my three children, but Gwendolyn, if you go on with the series, Gwendolyn is the one who changes the most. Marcus evolves the most, and Catherine is the one who's the stalwart that you can always count on. So I've got three different personalities, but Gwendolyn, yeah, people love Gwendolyn.
But I thought, so my impressions is sort of things I thought about the book. I have a review that's going to go up at the same time as the as the interview, so that'll be a two-prong thing. But I liked it. I liked the book overall. I had a few little quibbles, but nothing major. But I liked all three characters. I thought that the stuff with Gwendolyn was a lot of fun to read, for sure. And I thought that the other two had, and her stuff reminded me of a lot of, she's got a lot of schemes, right? So, I mean, trying to get into the movies.
You needed to.
Reminded me of, you know, Gold Diggers of 1933 and 42nd Street. Had that kind of an old-time Ginger Rogers, early Ginger Rogers kind of thing going on for me, that I really liked. And something that I said in my review that I'll say now, it reminded me, not the setting, but sort of what you did reminded me of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where it was a mixture of fictional characters in Hollywood and real people, and they're all intermingling at this in this period piece, you know. And you know, there's a lot of characters that sort of pass by and are cameos. Like in that movie, it was Steve McQueen was one of them, and Cass Elliot. And in your book, you know, the Marx Brothers are in there for a minute. Ginger Rogers shows up for a little bit. But then in the, you know, in that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Sharon Tate's a major character. Yeah. Charles Manson's in it for a while. And in your book, there was a lot of characters. You know, there was a good amount of characters that was the same kind of thing. George Cukor was my favorite of the of those characters that were real people.
Yeah,
but and Tallulah Bankhead was another major one. Those were two of them, and Billy Wilkerson. I did an article about Ciro's, which he opened. So I mean, to me, and then Allah, of course. But I mean, to me, those were like the main few. And I liked all that stuff, and it reminded me. I mean, setting wise, I mean, the people, and I wrote this setting wise, it was more like The Aviator, but. It had a lot of the feel or thematic feel of something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but your book is 10 years old, almost 10 years older than that movie.
Yeah, what I set out to do was write a story with my fictional characters, write a story that didn't actually happen, but it could have, because the Garden of Allah Hotel actually existed. These people who weave in and out of those lives, they actually existed. As much as possible, those situations and events actually happened. So I'm weaving a fictional story of fictional people through as many factual events and developments as I could, which I hadn't quite drawn a parallel to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, it's kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that when I was reading it, I was like, it reminded me of it immediately, because I mean, the movie is only 15 months old. I mean, it's a new movie. So, I mean, it's, and I like that movie. It's fresh in my mind. And the other thing about it, it was that movie, people that don't like that movie, wouldn't maybe like your book, because your book is more character driven, like that movie is. It's more just about sort of the day in the life of these people, what they do, the situations they get into. I mean, it's not like James Bond or Star Wars, where it's all, you know, plot the whole way. But this is the opposite. It's more of a character piece. And that was my favorite thing about that movie, was that it was like that. And that's what I liked about your book, too.
Yeah. Yeah. The being the first book in the 9-book series, The Garden on Sunset is really about them just getting their foot in the door. Because just doing that, just getting your foot in the door with all that competition of, not just competition, but competition of talented, articulate, ambitious, creative people. Just getting your foot in the door is an achievement. And I knew where I plotted these books out ahead of time. So I knew where they were going to go. But just getting in the door, that's an achievement in itself. And so with the first book is just establishing themselves in their lives. And then in later books, their careers evolve and their relationships evolve. But first, you got to get in the door before you can make your mark. And that's what the first book is about. Yeah.
Now, I've got a lot of questions for you. Okay. How did you How did you learn about, well, how did you end up in LA being from Australia? How did that happen?
I worked in the travel industry and I got a job offer to come here for 3 years to manage a travel company, an Australian New Zealand travel company. And I was single and I had no mortgage. I thought, oh, okay. That sounds like an adventure. And, you know, that was 25 years ago and yada, yada, yada. I never quite left.
So are any of the, not having read the book, so I'm coming at it a little cleaner than Ben is, but I'm just curious, did you take, like, I mean, obviously you've done a lot of research into this and it's clear that you really know, your Hollywood history, and that'll be another question I'll get into. But I'm curious, did you take like a real life event, something that maybe is a story that is well known, and incorporate it into the novel, or is it just they kind of drift in and out, and there's nothing really specific there?
No, the entire 9-book series is filled with real life incidents that happened.
Oh, okay.
That I personally found interesting. I'm a big Gone with the Wind fan, and the Search for Scarlet I thought was a really interesting thing. So books 2 and 3 especially book 2 is about the Search for Scarlet and how that affected Hollywood and how Gone with the Wind itself changed Hollywood. So throughout the whole series there are these landmark events that probably as much as anything reflect my own interest, specific interest in Hollywood. But I've always found that was an interesting event because that changed this person's life who then went on to do this at that studio. So they were just interesting events. I thought, if I can find a way to put Gwendolyn in the middle of that, that would be interesting. But it would need to reflect her journey. It couldn't be just a bunch of random events. And I selected these events because I found them interesting and therefore they could reflect where each character was in their particular story. Keeping in mind, this is a 32-year saga I'm writing here.
Sure.
Because I spent a year researching because I thought if I'm going to write the history of Hollywood, I need to know what happened, when, who was involved, and what was the result of that. So I sat on my couch for a year and I bought every biography, autobiography, memoir, because these people at the Garden of Allah had big lives. So they wrote their memoirs or had a biography written about them. So everybody who stayed there had a book about them in one. So I bought them all. I made a list, bought them all, read them all. At the end of that, I had a very detailed timeline, which people can see on my website. I've put it up there.
Yeah, I saw that. I was like, oh, yeah. I love timelines. I got to go through that.
Me too. So that's what came out of that. So that was just me making notes as I went. So by the time I finished that, I kind of had an outline of what was going to happen. So then I spent another year outlining each book. So I wanted to know what was going to happen in each book, because I already knew that something in book 1 that happens in book 1 is going to come back to bite them in book 9. I thought, well, I need to know that all through the series, because that's kind of what happens. You make a decision, and then 5 years later, something pops up, like, okay, that wasn't a good decision 5 years ago, but here we are now, so I have to deal with it. So I wanted to pepper that through. So it was really a 2-year process before I started writing book 1, because I wanted to get all my historical ducks in a row and know the plot where I was going before I started writing. I'm glad I did, because it's an era that a lot happened. A lot happened in those 32 years.
Oh, yeah. And I guess, you know, that kind of takes me into another question. And what was it that kind of pushed you to be that got you so interested in the history of Hollywood in general?
It was always just there. As a kid, even before high school, I just loved to watch old movies on TV. During the school holidays, there was I'm from Melbourne in Australia, and, mm-hmm. and Channel 10 noon movie during the school holidays was on old movie. Maybe all year round, but when I was home, it was always an old movie. And I watched every day, I'd watch an old movie. And the guy who hosted the program, his name is Bill Collins, and he had a story for every movie. He probably had a ton of stories for every movie that he showed, but he always had a couple of really great, interesting behind the scenes. And I just soaked that up. And for me, it reminded me that these movies just didn't happen. Like, I'm 10, okay? So these movies just didn't happen. Somebody designed that dress that Ginger Rogers danced in. Somebody wrote the music that Gene Kelly's dancing to. And I just started reading the credits. So I'd look to see, okay, who did the costumes on this? Who was the lighting? Who was the cameraman? Who designed the sets? And I just always read that, those credits right through. And it was always just an interest. So when I hit on this idea for The Garden of Allah and found myself living in LA with that I never really thought I would have, that the two just sort of came together. I thought, well, that's just perfect, because I've been reading about these people for 20 years. I know exactly what I wanted to do. And that's when it all sort of fell into place for me.
Now, I've got a lot of questions for you just about the book and Hollywood in general. So in the book, one of the things towards the end is a place on the MGM lot called Cosmopolitan Pictures. Uh-huh. And it's funny, because I had never heard of that before Thursday or Wednesday. Oh, and then yesterday I watched Captain Blood for the first time.
Oh.
And that's a Cosmopolitan picture.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about Cosmopolitan Pictures for a minute, and then I'll get to my question?
Okay, so the richest man in America was William Randolph Hearst, who was a newspaper magnate. He had a mistress who was a bazillion years younger than him, quite a talented, she was a showgirl, a Ziegfeld showgirl, and he decided to pump up her movie career. I don't know that she really wanted one, but if Hearst is calling the shots, that's what happened. So he created a production company called Cosmopolitan Pictures, whose sole purpose really was to produce movies for Marion Davies. that started at MGM because Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg knew very well that if you've got the biggest newspaper owner in America, well, the world really, in your studio, you're going to get tons of publicity. That of course happened. Then that relationship fell apart, and he moved Lock, Stock and Barrel over to Warner Brothers. So they set up shop in Warner Brothers, which is why you saw Captain Blood, because that's a Warner Brothers. So the existence of Cosmopolitan Pictures was to create Marion Davies' movie career.
So how did they, in the book, I mean, and what I read briefly online, basically, most of the movies they made were like these romantic comedies or these farcical kind of movies. And then they end up making this, the only one I ever heard of is this pirate movie. How did that cause you know what?
I don't know the actual story of that. I've often wondered how exactly that happened. They were Warner Brothers by then.
Yeah.
And by the time...
Ben, don't stump the guest.
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting, because I just read the book and I watched this movie and they just sort of linked together.
It's an anomaly. I'm guessing that Marion's movie du jour wasn't quite ready yet, and so it was probably a money thing. Jack Warner probably had to shunt a bunch of money from one thing to another, and they had Captain Blood ready to roll. Errol Flynn was about to explode on the screen. It seemed like a good idea. You know what? If in doubt, it's the money. Basically, that's 99% of the explanation. So I'm guessing it probably had to do with budgets and money, and maybe Marion's picture wasn't ready. She had made one there with Clark Gable, where that's the one where they raised the roof of the biggest soundstage on the Warner Brothers lot. They raised it like 30 feet because they wanted a crane shot. So Hearst went, okay. So we paid for them to raise the roof of the soundstage, which increased the budget enormously, meaning the movie couldn't possibly have made any money, even with Clark Gable. But maybe that's where I would, if I was going to start researching that, which I might, now that you've raised the question, that's probably where I would start. Where was Cain and Mabel, and where was Captain Blood in all this? Because it was a huge expense that wasn't justified, because most of those movies didn't make money, because it was basically Hearst fulfilling his fantasy for his mistress. They didn't actually have to be any good. They didn't really care as long as he had his mistress up on the screen. So, yeah, that made money.
I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
A couple of the real life events that I didn't know anything about that were in the book. The Mon Falcone.
Mon Falcone. Yeah. 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 That was awesome. Yeah.
So that was like a gambling boat off the coast of California, right?
Yeah, California gambler's laws wouldn't allow gambling on land. So these barges is what they were, upgraded barges, anchored just outside the 3 mile limit, just off the coast. So they were outside the reach of the law until they weren't. But at the time, it was where you could go to gamble without being raided. And the Mon Falcone was the most famous. Mon Falcone and the Rex were the two most famous of the gambling ships over there.
Oh, that's funny, because in Missouri, where I'm right next to, they passed the riverboat gambling, and I think other states have done that as well. And so the idea was that you see these big stately ships, you know, the paddle wheels, like from the 1800s, do that. And what ended up happening is they build these big, giant, landlocked things, and they run a pipe underneath and say it's on water. So it's kind of funny that apparently they've been doing this for decades.
Yeah, whatever it takes.
Yep, too much money. You know, they don't build those things by giving away money.
And then the other one that was in there that was interesting to me was the earthquake, the 1933 earthquake,
right,
Long Beach. Yeah. That was pretty interesting. And I saw pictures of that after, when I was reading it, or right after I read that part. You're talking about this old time architecture. It wasn't built to be sustainable from that kind of large scale earthquake.
It was one of the events that started to reform how buildings were made in California, because it was a shocking reminder that these buildings were very vulnerable and they weren't built to withstand earthquake in earthquake territory. So when that came along...
You're talking the Garden of Allah Hotel, or just in general?
Oh, buildings in general.
Just buildings in general, okay.
It was set in Long Beach, so Long Beach took the brunt of it, and really took the brunt of it. And they thought, well, this earthquake could have actually happened in downtown. It could have happened in Culver City, where MGM is, or Burbank, where Warner Brothers is. They felt it. They felt it. I know they felt it in MGM. I don't know that they felt it all the way in the valley where Warner's is. But it was a stark reminder that, yeah, we better do something about this, because whole apartment houses came down and walls fell off. And it was, they were lucky it was like 6 o'clock in the evening. They were lucky for a number of reasons. They thought, well, we've just gotten through that one. Let's start doing something. So at the time, that was a big deal in LA, because it was just quite a thing.
Yeah, I've read stories about, you know, the earthquake back then, how much fell apart. The other thing we noticed, your first book has a lot of parties in it, and things in it, including Mickey Mouse's birthday party at the Coconut Grove in 29, the 3333 party at the Garden. Did they all take place, or did you invent some of them, or is it all just you try to use as much historical stuff as possible?
Yeah, the latter. There was so much that happened. I didn't really need to invent anything. The Disney did throw Mickey Mouse birthday party at the Coconut Grove, and the 3333 party happened at the Garden of Allah. There, so much happened that I actually didn't really need to invent. What I invented was more about the fictional lives of the three fictional characters. Most of the rest of it was either actually happened or based on something that actually happened. Because, you know, by the time I started writing, I'd read 100 different memoirs. So I had a lot of stories that I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if I can weave that in. If I couldn't, I wove in something like that suited my plot. But my general rule of thumb was, if I can stick to a factual, actual event, then I would. And for the most part, I was able to get away with it. Yeah.
Yeah, that, I liked all that stuff. You know, I think a lot of people probably do that. That those events that are peppered through the book.
Right.
Yeah. You know what? The three main characters, were they based on anybody in particular? Did they, or were they completely? I mean, was there any inspiration for them in any real people at all, or were they just complete fabrications?
They were complete fabrications that came to me whole. When I realized, okay, I've got a story here that spans the golden years of Hollywood, and I've got a hotel that was there, I could have some fictional characters to come in, and boom, there they were. I knew their names, I knew their backgrounds, I knew their stories, their life stories, I knew what it was like to be around them, to talk with them, to be friends with them. They just sort of just downloaded whole into my mind, and I didn't have to change anything about them. They were just there, and I don't know why, and I don't know how, but they were just there from literally day one. They were there, fully formed, whole. They weren't based on anybody. A few of their shenanigans they get up to may have been drawn from real life, like other actresses, other screenwriters. But generally speaking, no, they were just fully formed. They just came to me whole, and they stayed exactly as I conceived them on day one.
You know what it sounds like to me? I'm listening to you talk about, how you put this all together. It sounds like the characters, like you had all these events, and that the characters were like the real easy for you to just stick in all the holes to link all the events correctly. And that it sounds like that they came to you because of, you know, you say, well, if this person was here and that person was there and this person was there, if I have a screenwriter here and an actress here, and then it sounds like it just all came together for you like a bang. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah. Big Bang Theory. That's pretty much the way it happened. They were just there, and all I had to do was write them down. Oh my! I mean, writing a novel isn't quite that automatic.
Oh, I know.
But bringing them to life was the easiest part of it. Probably plotting around actual events, putting these people into the right time and place to be a part of whichever event I'm writing about. It took a year of plotting all that out, but writing them and their reactions and their relationships and who they were, that was no effort. It was like writing about you and your two best friends who you've known for 30 years, which, yeah.
That helps.
One thing we haven't mentioned during this thing is that this book is free, isn't it, on your website, right?
It's free on all retail outlets, Amazon, Nook, Kobo, wherever. Because I actually the suggestion came from my editor. When I was doing book four, we were just finalizing book four. She said, you know, if you made book one free, that would be easier for people to take a chance on somebody who's never heard of you, which back then hardly anybody had. And I thought, oh, that took me a year to write. You want me to give it away free? Oh, but she had a point. She said, well, you know, if they like book one, they're going to like books 2, 3, 4 and onwards. So it's a good way to get people into the world who may not know much about Hollywood even really. I went, yeah, that makes sense. So I thought, well, let me just try it. And she was right. It was like the cocaine dealer giving you a free bag. Just take a little taste then. And now if you like it, you come back and you pay for more. Well, those cocaine dealers know what they're doing, because the whole game changed. When I launched book four and made book one free, whole game changed. My visibility, my sales, my profile jumped up a couple of notches with that. And I thought, well, I'm glad I took that plunge, because, you know, it's a year's worth of work. And especially when it's your first book. Well, that wasn't the first book I wrote. It was actually the fourth book I wrote, but it was the first book that I thought was good enough to be published. That's a year's worth of effort there. And to give away that for free, it was a bit, oh, okay, I'll give it a go. I'll give it 3 months, see if it may change the needle at all. And boom, it changed the needle. So I tend people who are deciding, or people who've read book one, I tell them, okay, if you like book one, you like the rest, because that tone continues, and that structure of the revolving point of view of the three people giving you like a 360 view of Hollywood. That's kind of how I see it. Between the three of them, they give you a 360 view of what was going in Hollywood at any given time. So if you like book one, you like book two, three, and on the go.
Yeah. Now one of the things that I thought was interesting that we haven't touched on at all was sort of this whole, and I didn't know anything about it before I read the book. I mean, I knew just from my research and my one article about the Garden of Allah, you know, the sort of the gay and lesbian sort of underground subculture. You know, there was a lot of people back then, you know, in the movie business that were, you know, homosexuals. And, you know, there were people trying to get, you know, catch them in a bind or set them up, you know, and everybody's trying to be secretive and they're doing this stuff and trying not to get caught. All of that stuff, I thought that the chapter at George Cukor's house,
right,
was one of the best chapters in the book, I thought.
Right.
Just for the fact that, I mean, it was good information. I mean, it was, I felt like I really learned something.
Right.
In that chapter, you know, in the situations. I mean, maybe that exact situation didn't happen.
No, it did.
But, I mean, it was good.
Yeah, thank you. Well, what's always fascinated me and about this era is that the effort that it took to project this image of perfection on the screen, where everybody is gorgeous, everybody's dressed beautifully, everybody's hair is gorgeous, and everything is just this image of perfection to the ultimate. That took a high price. And that's why you have a lot of people from this era with a lot of divorces, a lot of alcoholism, a lot of, you know, going broke. It took a lot to get that image of perfection. What I like to explore is, what was the cost of that, of that image of, to maintain that image of perfection? And movies aren't a one horse team. It takes a lot of people to make a movie, and a lot of people put a lot of hours and put a lot of effort into that. So I want to examine what the cost of that was, because the prize was so great and the prizes were so big and golden and glittering and well paid. What's the price of that? And for people who weren't, you know, heterosexual Christian white people, there were extra prices to be paid. And I wanted to explore the underbelly, where Hollywood is a place that has big, huge, bright spotlights shining on it. So where there's a lot of lights, there's also a lot of shadow. And I think there's a lot of interesting stuff goes on in the shadows, the prices that people pay. And people like George Cukor, who was A-list of the A-list, but he was also a homosexual. In an era when publicly that wasn't acceptable, privately, Hollywood, especially the 20s and going into the 30s, Hollywood was pretty much do whatever you like, we don't care. Until the code came along in 33, the production code, that made everything very, very square, it was pretty much, do what you like behind closed doors, I really don't care. But that changed too. So there was also, because also, it wasn't what you want as a gay man, what you like to do wasn't legal. So Louis B. Mayer or Irving Thalberg might be okay with you being gay, but the law isn't. And if you're caught out in a raid and there's a journalist there, he will publish your name and address in the paper and explain what you were caught doing. And that could be the end of your career. So I thought, well, that's a high wire act that a lot of people had to tread for a very long time. And ditto women in a different way. If you were an ambitious, articulate woman, like if you were Dorothy Asner, who was a director,
yes.
If you were one of those people, one of those women who are like Alina Zimova herself, who was articulate, ambitious, talented, intelligent. There was only a few places you could go, and Hollywood was one of them. But even then, it had your limits. So how do you maneuver around this system that is accepting in some ways, but has ceilings in other ways? And so Marcus being a gay man in that era, I felt made for an interesting dynamic that we could explore and explore the evolution of that as time goes on.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, he's in there, you know, and you know, because of that, because he's a gay, he meets people and he gets in these scenarios and he helps people get out of these binds they get in, and he gets into all this trouble knowing these people, you know, and helping get them out of trouble and all sorts of stuff.
Right.
I thought all that stuff to me was really, a lot of that was really interesting. Just for the fact that I didn't ever know anything about any of that stuff.
Right. Yeah, it's that funny. It's all completely the opposite now. Did you go to church? No, I swear I'm gay. Oh, you're out of here.
Yeah, these things evolve, and Hollywood, the game changed every couple of years. You know, we got sound. That changed things. We got color. That changed everything.
Sure.
We got the war. That changed everything. We got the rise of anti-communist Red Scare. That changed everything. Television changed everything. So every couple of years, the game changes, and they have to reconfigure how they make costumes, how they paint sets, where do they put microphones, how do they make a widescreen bigger than a TV, and you know, it that's what made this era so interesting to write about, because every couple of years, they had to rethink everything. So there was that dynamic going on as well.
I thought that all of that stuff was really interesting. And I also thought that, you know, that Catherine trying to make it, you know, as a journalist, I thought all that stuff was pretty good. And I'm thinking, you know, this book goes on for about 9 years. Almost 10 years, and I'm reading this going, I can't believe that none of these people give up. I mean, they're still trying to, you know, eight or 9 years go by, and then they finally start making some headway.
Right.
But I'm thinking, you know, how did these people, you know, because I mean, to me, they were real, they seem like real characters, you know. I'm going,
yeah. Yeah.
Why didn't these people give up by yet?
Yeah, I give up on, you know, food if the microwave takes too long.
This Hollywood attracts the sort of people who are willing to wait 20 years for their big break. And,
right.
And some people, like I think like Helen Hayes, she was around and she made movies, but her career didn't get going until she started looking like a little old lady. So sometimes, there are a lot of people like that. Like, they've been around for years, they get a role in a movie that turns out to be a big hit, and suddenly their career goes boom. But they want that so bad, they will keep plugging away, and they'll keep plugging away. So maybe they'll have to take a job at the Five and Dime to get by to eat. But as soon as there's a chance, boom, they're there in front of putting themselves in front of the casting director at RKO, and they'll see if they can finally get their break. They will wait years to do that. And I think that was probably more so back then than now. Keeping in mind, of course, a lot of these people came out of vaudeville. So vaudeville, there may have been somebody in vaudeville. They may not have been a big time, they may have been a medium time. And they had that taste, and then vaudeville dies, but movies are sucking up all this talent, so I've made it in vaudeville, surely I can do it again in the movies if I can just get my big break, if I can just speak to the right person, the right casting director, the right screenwriter. Well, not the screenwriter, because nobody cared about them. But yeah, you know, these people, they would plug away and they would plug away until they either got there or died.
That's
I don't think, crazy. I think it wasn't really stretching for that time and place. It wasn't really stretching the imagination to think, yeah, like you said, it's been 10 years, give up already, it ain't going to happen.
Right.
It could happen with the next casting session could easily happen.
Sure.
And then your whole life changes.
One of the questions I had for you, this is more of a kind of a weird question. So Marcus, in the very first chapter, he's from Western Pennsylvania, and you mentioned Newcastle, Pennsylvania on like page 2. So my father's from Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Now, how do you know about Newcastle, Pennsylvania being from Melbourne, Australia?
Because McKeesport, Pennsylvania was where the very first Nickelodeon opened.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, I remember that in the book.
Right, so when I read that, I mean, I didn't know who McKeesport was. I thought, that's interesting. So his spark of what he wants to do comes from the fact that the one claim to fame that this little town in Pennsylvania has is the place that the first Nickelodeon opened. That would be, if I were him, if I were that kid in 1920, 1919, whatever it was, saw that and saw the entire growth of movies started from that place up the street, if I were that kid, I would want to follow that. And so it seemed like a fairly good place. Yes, he has to come from somewhere.
So I thought,
let's put him, give him the place that, you know, basically the movies as we now know them, that's where they started.
So that's there's a lot of great information in this book. I mean, I recommend it for sure. You know, just for the fact that there's, I mean, I really liked it. I've got some just general questions for you. I think, what are some of your favorite, like, what are your 5 or 10 favorite movies, and who's your five, you know,
yeah, let me,
a couple of favorite actors and actresses of all time.
And let me add on to that, yeah, you know, when you said you were, you got interested in this because you used to watch old movies, and then you would, you know, I mean, I think that any of us on the site can kind of understand that. I mean, I watched Star Wars. Next thing I know, I'm looking at how Industrial Light and Magic works. Who's George right. Lucas? Who's Steven Spielberg? You know, so a child of the 80s, I was all into that. So I can certainly understand that. And of course, that love of movies kind of spurred me to start, you know, delving into older movies, you know, Hitchcock and Casablanca. One of my favorites is still Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you know. So, but yeah, we'd love to hear, you obviously are much more of a fan of the golden age. So what is your top movie in that age? And as Ben says, the actor, actresses, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. If we started with movies, because I don't have a top movie or performer. That's too hard. Just don't pay me to one. In no particular order.
No, we're pinning you down, man. You have to. This is part of the deal. We paid you. You're going.
Sorry,
no, I'm kidding.
My connection is breaking up. My connection is breaking
oh,
up.
Oh, there we go.
So movies in no particular order. Let's see. They would be Casablanca, Maltese Falcon.
Fair.
Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, Mrs. Miniver, Now Voyager, Mildred Pierce. So performers-wise, performers-wise would be Humphrey Bogart, especially with Lo and Bacall.
He was number one, I think, on our readers list.
Yeah, we did a greatest actor and actress poll.
Yep.
Oh,
Bogart came in at number one.
Yep.
Doesn't surprise me. I think because he's relatable. He's not Cary Grant handsome. He's every man type. So I think people could relate to him, and he started out as a movie thug, but he ended up a romantic hero. And I think that's because people felt they knew him and they could relate to him. He might be in a town nobody ever heard of in the Western Sahara, but we can still relate to him because he was more everyman. So,
hey, I hate to say it, I think African Queen is his best role.
Oh, yeah, let's put African Queen in there too. Yeah, yeah. Performers. Oh, and North by Northwest. I'm a big fan of North by Northwest.
Fantastic. Too. My favorite Hitchcock. Yeah.
Me too. I could watch that a million times. Mm-hmm. Performers-wise, so that would be Bogart Bacall, Greer Garson, Judy Garland and Gene Kelly.
Singing in the Rain, my favorite musical ever.
Let's add Singing in the Rain to that. Yep.
It's so many. It's hard. I know. I'm putting you on the spot here. I apologize.
I do enjoy a good Errol Flynn's Swashbuckler. I like Clark Gable in the right roles. Ava Gardner, I really like.
Yeah.
I need to see your list from your poll and select, but those are the ones that come to mind. The others tend to be certain actors in a certain role. You know, it's a classic role when you can't imagine anybody else in that role. Like Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
Paulette Goddard, who was choice number two, she would have been fine, but Vivien Leigh elevates it to sort of next level classic, can't imagine anybody else in the role kind of stuff.
That's like Indiana Jones with Harrison Ford, right? Tom Selleck was supposed to be Indiana Jones, but he couldn't do it. So then
and he would have been
Harrison Ford and, you know.
Yeah. Like, forget it. Forget everybody else. That's
right. You have a lot of silent, there's a lot of silent actors and actresses and movies are mentioned. Do you like a lot of silent movies, or I personally find them, I mean, I like some, but
yeah,
it's too far removed for me. There's something about it that's too different.
It's usually hard.
I mean,
it is.
Do you like those movies, or is it inaccessible for you?
Yeah, not my preference, because I'm really more of a words guy, and especially like a Rosalind Russell in Front Page with Cary Grant going boom 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 boom.
Sure.
I love that. That's what I love. Rosalind Russell, she'd be another one, yeah, who I love. So I love it when there's clever, witty, sparkling, razor sharp dialogue that goes back and forth. That's kind of, so screwball-y comedy kind of stuff is what I really enjoy. So silent movies don't have that, obviously.
And sure.
A Harold Lloyd or a Charlie Chaplin or something like that. But that's, to me, that's the only way I can watch a silent movie, because it doesn't really require any words. I tried watching Metropolis, which I know is supposed to be a science fiction masterpiece. And it's just, it's rough to get through it.
Yeah. There is a Greta Garbo made a version of Anna Karenina that I did really enjoy, because the art direction, the lighting, the cinematography was really like art in motion. Like, and that was probably for me the pinnacle of silent cinema. And then sound came along and the whole thing changed. Mm. Oh, Greta Garbo is another one. I'll probably watch anything she's in. But
yeah, I like Garbo a lot. Ninotchka.
Yeah. Oh,
all that stuff's great.
Yeah.
Grand Hotel.
Grand Hotel. Put that one in too. Grand Hotel. Love that.
Yeah.
It's, wait, I gotta start writing this shit down.
You know, there's something about, let me say something about Grand Hotel. I think that that's the only time Joan Crawford ever looks great. When she looks a certain way, then all of a sudden, like after that, she looks like a completely different person. It's really weird to me. Do you agree or not?
Oh, you've gone mute on me somehow.
Wow.
Okay, here we go.
There you go.
Okay, so I would agree, but I would put that point later in her career. I would put that point sort of post Mildred Pierce. She always had a look, but after Mildred Pierce, well, let's say Warner Brothers, by the time she got to Warner Brothers in the, what was that, early 40s?
Yeah.
Her screen persona, much like Betty Davis, her screen persona kind of calcified into Joan Crawford. And by that
all her hangers.
Yeah. All her tricks and all her eyebrow raises and the way she would turn, the way she would walk, and the characters she agreed to play, they all became carbon copies of each other. And with Mildred Pierce, it was, again, the perfect role for the perfect actress at the perfect point in her life. But after that, she just became mannered and almost cliched. And just when you got the drag queens imitating you, that's when you're frozen in time, and that's what you're going to be stuck with forever. And that kind of happened, that sort of very Joan Crawford type of persona, as did Betty Davis, happened around that, and it just became too mannered to become believable. Don't get me wrong, I'll still watch anything that they're in.
Right.
But it's there's a point at which they just started to rely on the mannerism. Another good example of that is Mae West. She found a thing that worked for her, and she stayed with it for the next 50 years. She played Mae West for the rest of her life.
Yes.
And I never really thought about that until I watched an early television interview where it was a live cross to her apartment at the Ravenswood. And I forget who was interviewing her, but he said something kind of unexpected and funny. And she laughed, but she didn't laugh like Mae West. She laughed like a real person. And you just see, like, I laughed. Oh, I'm laughing like, no, I need to snap back into my persona. And for like maybe half a second, you caught a glimpse into the real Mae West, and it wasn't this persona that she had built. That at that point, that was the 60s, so she'd been playing Mae West for 40 years. And I thought, oh.
It's like Rubens and Pee Wee Herman.
You found something worked for you, and it really worked for her, but she didn't evolve, and that's why her career kind of petered out. Like, she's still, she may have transferred it to the Vegas stage, but she's still playing Mae West. And I thought, that's the danger. You get stuck in the persona that worked for you at a certain point in your career, and you don't evolve beyond that.
Now,
wasn't Mae West in that that weird transgender thing with Rex Reed, Myra Breckinridge?
Myra Breckinridge, yeah.
I've never seen that movie. I heard it's the worst.
I think Rex Reed actually panned his own movie. That was that's what I knew. I love Rex Reed, but he crapped on his own movie. That's funny.
It is hard to watch.
Yeah, it's rough. Yeah. So you brought up Mildred Pierce a couple of times, and I've never seen the original.
Oh,
I did watch the HBO miniseries, Mildred Pierce, which I think was like four or six 1 hour episodes. It was really long and drawn out. I think it starred Kate Winslet, and it was fine. And I don't know if you've seen the remake or not. You have. So what did you think of that? And in general, do you think there's very many times a remake is worth it? Because it seems like today in Hollywood, all we're getting is remakes or redos or reboots, if it's not a franchise. And even the franchises, right. I mean, Star Wars was just the Force Awakens was Star Wars, and then the other two were a mess. And it's kind of like I don't know if Hollywood's just too afraid to do anything original anymore or something like that, but I'm just curious what's your take on that, Mildred Pierce specifically, and then in general.
My take is that Mildred Pierce, the movie, the remake, is the opposite of what usually happens. With the miniseries, it stretched out the two-hour story the movie was.
Yeah.
It stretched that same story out into 6 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. The movie told that story succinctly and beautifully, and it followed the plot of the books. I've also read the book. It followed the plot fairly faithfully. You could tell that story in 2 hours. You didn't need 6 hours to tell that story.
I agree. I thought it was way too long from what I saw. And so now I want to see the original. It's just one of those things. It's on my to-do list.
Dude, you'll see what I mean. It's like, well, it's the same story, but it's in 2 hours, and you don't feel like it's a rush 2 hours. Whereas a lot of movies that were originally books, they chop out a lot of story, backstory, to fit the story into 2 hours. I'm a fan of remaking movies if they put all that story back in and aren't in such a hurry to move from this plot point to this plot point to this plot point to this plot point in order to get it done under 2 hours, and away we go. If there's a 6 hour story, I will happily sit through and expanded version of a movie if it's A, done well, and B, done if there's 6 hours worth of story to tell. If there isn't, then don't waste my time, which I thought the remake of Mildred Pierce was done really well in terms of art direction and recreation of Hollywood.
Yeah, they get that stuff right all the time. It's the pacing and the plot, the characters.
It's like, are we still talking? She hasn't even met him yet. Oh my God, she's still cooking the chicken dinners. All right. So if it's a 6 hour story, then I'll give you my 6 hours. I will happily, but.
You know, a good example of that is Lord of the Rings, right? The original Lord of the Rings movies were long, but they worked. I never felt they were long. And then they makes The Hobbit, and it's like, good God, that mess of a movie that is way too long, because it's just one book and they stretch it out into three overly long movies.
They had extended editions of those things.
Yeah. My friend made me sit through them. I don't know if it's indulgence or just not understanding pacing, or, you know, you can always go back to money, of course. But it's bizarre to me how they make movies today that they're not willing to have quiet moments in them anymore. There's a few, like that Lighthouse was interesting with Willem Dafoe. Yeah. But, right, you know, you they're always small. They're not big budget anymore. They're not something that's going to be out in the main theaters. And there's a real divergence between, at this point, what the public will see and Hollywood's ability to relate to the public. Because as weird as the parties and the craziness would get in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s that you related, they at least made stuff that people wanted to see. And that's not happening anymore, other than the big, you know, a Marvel movie or something like that. But I'm like, as much as I love movies, we built this whole website because of that. Why can't they make stuff that I want to watch anymore?
I think the guys who ran these studios during the golden era, so we're talking Louis B. Mayer at MGM, Jack Warner at Warner Brothers, Harry Cohn at Columbia, and all the others, they get a lot of flack for being very coarse people who, you know, would have their 3 p.m. girls every afternoon, or doing whatever they got up to.
Sure.
But it's a very difficult job to keep your finger on the pulse of the American public and its changing taste, and give the public the movies that they want. Of course, they didn't do it all the time, but they had, overall, they did a pretty good job of it. And I think that's because none of them were particularly well educated. They didn't go to Harvard, they didn't go to, you know, Yale, they didn't get these fancy degrees in marketing or branding or they were, to some degree, of course, you know, they got rich doing it, but I think inside they were still Mr. and Mrs. Joe Schmo from Pittsburgh, because that's where they came from.
No, I agree. One of my favorite sayings is that sometimes ideas are so stupid that only an educated intellectual could have came up with it. And I think that so you trace the stuff into the 60s, or at least the Late Garden 50. Of Allah went out in 59. It's no coincidence to me that that's about when studios, the big studio system, started falling apart. The Warners, the Mayers, all those guys were either getting old or they were dying off or whatever. It was getting sold to, like, I think Columbia got sold to Coca-Cola and things like that. And they did try some interesting things in the 70s. I'll give them that. You know, it did give us things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and some other stuff.
The Godfather.
But right now, it's all just corporate thinking. Yeah, it's just product. It's not art.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas I think the sort of the Netflix model is that they're not tied to a 1 hour with commercial breaks every 14 and a half minutes. So you script it so there's a cliffhanger every 14 and a half minutes. Blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot more freedom to create the story you want, and you don't have to tell it in, you know, 12 episodes make a season. If people want to tell their story in 7 episodes, then tell it in 7 episodes. Those rules have sort of gone away, and I think that television has benefited for that, and we absolutely in turn have.
Yeah, so that's where the creativity is, absolutely. And, you know, credit HBO, you know, they kind of blazed the way on that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it even before COVID happened, I'm a movie fan. I probably went to the movies maybe once a year. I think I went to see the Harry Potters on a big screen. Maybe an Avatar I went to see on 3D. But I wasn't going anymore, because I looked down the movie like, well, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see that. Who cares about that? No. But TV is like, well, we've got a whole embarrassment of riches there that I will happily not leave my house and watch when I want, how I want.
So this pandemic came just at the right time for you, huh?
Suits me.
Well, Martin, I had a back to Mildred Pierce for a second.
Oh yeah,
I've got a trivia question for you.
Oh yeah.
At what restaurant was some of Mildred Pierce shot? What famous restaurant?
I actually would have said it was all on the back lot. Did they actually shoot it at an actual restaurant?
Yeah, they shot the restaurant scenes at the Los Feliz Brown Derby.
Did they?
Yes. I've got an article about it. It's in there. I pulled it up because I didn't remember exactly which one it was at. I wrote an article. It's called The Rise and Fall of the Brown Derby, and got the whole history of the restaurants. There was four locations. But that location, Mildred Pierce was shot there in 1945. And then after it closed in the 70s, they used that restaurant exterior for Arnold's drive-in on Happy Days.
Did they? Wow. Yes. You've got me twice there. I did not know that. Now that I'm thinking it, I can see that they would have. Now that you put two and two together for me, I'm gonna Google your article, because the Brown Derby is one of my pet interests. I love all of that.
Well, you can find it on lastmovieoutpost.com. As long as we're talking here, and on our website, you can see our top 15 stars and movies as chosen by our readers. I will use any moment I can to pimp out our place. I'm a horrible whore. I'll cop to that.
And just one more plug. I've written about 3 dozen articles about Hollywood history now. People really like them. And that's, you know, sort of how Martin and us got together is he read one of mine, and I was following him already on Facebook.
Oh.
And I didn't see your comment until about a month after you posted it. And then I reached out to him and said, hey, do you want to do this? And he said, sure.
I had to go back and go, what comment was that?
we're really on top of these things, obviously.
Yeah, thinking within the last couple of days, I'm thinking, I ripped a comment? Google. Oh, that one, right.
So, we, you know, some of the ones that we did, besides Brown Derby, Garden of Allah, the most popular one that I ever wrote, it's called The Hollywood Ghost of Roxbury Drive. It's about all of the houses on Roxbury Drive in Beverly Hills.
Oh,
where
yeah.
All of the big stars lived.
Yeah.
Jimmy Stewart lived next door to Lucille Ball. Yeah. On the other side of Lucille Ball was Jack Benny. Across the street
was the first one you wrote, wasn't it?
That was the very, very first one. And
it killed it.
It's the most and it
was interesting. I mean, I found myself going down the rabbit hole on that one.
So, you know, in that one I've got personal photographs of Agnes Moorhead at her house in the late 60s, early 70s, and Ginger Rogers' house. There's 24 celebrities or something that lived on this street in these houses. And it's, it took a lot of time to research. I mean, it took about a week, not a year, but I mean, it took about a week. And no one had really put anything as comprehensive as I did. I mean, it wasn't like I could just read two or three things and...
Oh, there was a lot of people. Together. When I take people around LA, that street is the center point of my tour, because it's like, and in that house, and in that house, and in that house, and where that house used to be, and that. And I always make a point of when we pass the site where the Gershwin house used to be.
Yes.
I think my friends, okay, everybody, stink eye. So that monstrosity, that McMansion there, because they tore down Gershwin's house, so we hate them, so everybody stink eye to the left.
What was funny was, so I wrote this thing, and it was, you know, it went viral. I mean, it really did. And a lady that lived on that street in the 70s, Clark Gable's widow lived on that street with Clark Gable Jr.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had, you know, 20 people in this article. She emails me and says, hey, you missed a bunch. Give me a call and I'll tell you where they lived and you can put them in there. So I added Oscar Levant in there.
All right. Yeah.
And there were Kay Williams, Gable's widow. I didn't have her in there. Uh-huh. And there may have been one or two more. Hedy Lamarr's in there. There's a lot of people that lived on that street.
Oh, I'll have to Google that one as well, because Because I've got a pretty good list, but it doesn't sound as quite as comprehensive as yours.
Yeah, but mine became more comprehensive
after I wrote it.
I mean, I wrote it and I had to add 6 more people.
Yeah. Feel free to use us for any research you want for your next book there.
But one of the things that was funny on that street was, so the Gershwins were there, and Ginger Rogers was a couple blocks down, or it might have been a block, but she was just down the street. And, you know, that was when they were making the same, you know, they were writing the music for, you know, her Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers movies. And she's just, you know,
just a
short little walk a block down the street, you know, she's just there.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that are interesting to me like that. Though these things that I think it's interesting to you too, based on your book, you know, that these things are connected. There's connections here on a different level than you'd ever realize. You know, I'd never think that. And I said, oh, you know what? That's pretty good. You know, that's really interesting that was sort of happening.
Yeah. One of the criticisms I get of the books is people saying, there's no way that those three characters could meet all these people all the time, every time they step outside their front door. Oh, they're bumping into this person or that person. And like, well, actually, yeah, they could. And yeah, they did, because A, it was the Garden of Valor where these people actually lived. And B, Los Angeles wasn't 10 million people.
Right.
It was less than a million. It wasn't a one industry town, but it was oil, aviation, and movies, mainly movies. So if you were in town, working person, whatever your trade, if you were a working person in Hollywood, you eventually would meet all these people, work with all these movies. You shift to a studio, they shift to a studio. You would actually, and if you went to the Coconut Grove, or if you went to the Academy Awards, or you went to Ciro's, yeah, actually, you would. You would sit next to Ava Gardner and Frank Sinatra, because they're sociable, ambitious people. So are you. You're out and about. You're successful. They're successful. It's a constant hubbub of people and studios and jobs, which is why I the Garden of Valor appealed to me, because it seemed like a microcosm of Hollywood. It had lots of interesting, clever, ambitious people who lived near each other. And Hollywood is a city of talented, ambitious people who move from studio to studio and end up working with everybody. It's one of those maxims in Hollywood is you don't insult anybody, because you could probably be working with them on your next picture. That actually happened. Well, yeah, actually, they did, because it wasn't that big a town. It is now, but we're talking especially pre-war. Post-war is different, because the post-war boom that happened in LA. But pre-war, yeah, kind of everybody knew each other, because they were working together and they were playing together and they were probably sleeping together and drinking together. So it was a much smaller town and a much more closed community, where everybody talked shop all day and all night and knew each other because you worked with each other. So it's not really a valid criticism if you're thinking that LA back then is LA now. No.
Well, even now, I mean, how often do you see some trade rag saying, oh, this actor and this singer, or these two actors have gotten together romantically or something like that, and they never even worked together on a set? And, I'm in IT. I run into IT guys all the time. It's a big city, but I still run into the same circles. So, at that time, I don't think that sounds very believable to me.
Yeah.
So I don't want to keep you much longer, Martin. I know we've been on here for almost an hour and a half. And, that said, I mean, I'll give you an open invitation. I mean, if you want to do something like that again, we can do different topics and we can talk about different kinds of things. If you ever want to do this again, I think that, okay, that we're open.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to ask you, you know, for my last question.
Okay.
If somebody was going to come to LA and they wanted to do the, what would be your old Hollywood itinerary? Would it be including restaurants? I mean, would you include Muzo and Frank's? Would you include the Smokehouse? What kind of places and things would you have somebody do?
um, Actually, I would probably take him to lunch at Musso and Frank's and take him to dinner at the Smokehouse. So for people who don't know, Musso and Frank's is Hollywood's oldest continuously running restaurant. Okay, we're going to assume they've surviving COVID-19 and they bounce back. Okay, let's just assume that. So they've been around since 1919 and they're very old school. A whole bunch of things have been filmed there. And it's the best taste of old Hollywood that you can get in a restaurant, probably in all of LA. And the Smokehouse is the equivalent, really, in the San Fernando Valley. It's opposite Warner Brothers, so it's where all the Warner Brothers people would go and basically have a martini lunch.
Studio was near there too, right?
Walt Disney's around the corner. And Universal's around the other corner as well. So I would probably do that. I would also take them. I would take them to Warner Brothers. Because their studio tour is the most authentic.
Yeah, that was the one I liked the best of the two I did.
And I'm not saying that because I used to be a tour guide there. I tour guided there for a summer, and it's by far the most authentic experience. If you want to see an old Hollywood studio, it's the most authentic experience you'll have there. So that would be on the itinerary, probably in the afternoon, so we could have dinner at the Smokehouse afterwards. Yes. I normally take people around Beverly Hills and into the Hollywood Hills just to give people an idea of what it's like up there, because we've heard about the Hollywood Hills so much.
So the Smokehouse, La La Land was shot at the Smokehouse, in case people didn't know. Yeah. The scenes were what's the name of that actor?
Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling plays the piano.
Okay. That's
like a guy in that restaurant. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the scenes with Al Pacino at the beginning of that movie are shot at Musso and Frank.
Yes, yes. And once you've been in there, you go, oh, yes, I think this all looks very familiar, because that gets used a lot. Because it's one of the few places left in Hollywood, actual Hollywood, that looks like it did back in the day when people were boozing it away at 3-hour martini lunches in the 30s and 40s. It hasn't really changed. I don't know that the menus even changed all that much. So, and if time allowed, I would also take people to downtown LA. Downtown is where a lot of the history is, like the Biltmore Hotel and the Angels Flight, and there's a whole bunch of places. I've kind of got to walk through downtown LA that I can point out. And I start with Union Station, the main railway station of LA. Union Station was built in 1939, right before the war, and it's exactly the same as it was back then, and it is a beautiful building. So I usually start there and kind of work our way downtown through various eras of LA. That's a very full day. That's probably a 2 days itinerary worth.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you're making it sound great. I could be there Tuesdays. Tuesday
works for me. Yeah.
Mark, when we started talking about restaurants, I was reminded. That's why I got up and went someplace with the camera. I don't know if you have this book, but I think you'll love it. It's not my book. I didn't write it. It's called LA's Legendary Restaurants. Do you have this one?
It's hard to tell.
I'm good friends with the author. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I think great.
He really knows stuff. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things I liked. I mean, I liked some of my ideas for articles come from things in that book, because I mean, I'm not an LA native, so I mean, you know, I get an inspiration. I do research. You know, I use that book, and then I go other places and look for different things, and I sort of just. I like to weave it all together in a new way.
It's probably the best book that documents LA's restaurant scene in the era that I write about anyway. That's, yeah, if it ain't in there, it's not interesting. Yeah, he did a great job.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fantastic book. I didn't know if you had it or not, or even
heard of it. Oh, yeah.
So, we just plugged your friend's book. It's a great book. Yeah. If anybody that wants to buy a book with pictures of old movie stars having a salad at Ciro's or something. It's great.
Yeah.
The other book that I read that was terrific was the My Lunches with Orson. Have you read that book?
No, I haven't. Is that good?
It's fantastic. Orson Welles, badmouths, everybody.
Oh, he does.
The only people that he doesn't, that he, so Richard Burton and Elizabeth, it's at this Ma Mason, that restaurant.
Yeah.
So Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor are eating at a couple tables over. So Burton comes over and says, hey, do you mind if Elizabeth wants to say hello? Do you mind if I bring her over and she talks for a minute? And Wells tells him, no, don't. He says, you know what? I'm eating. Guess what? I'll stop by your table when I'm done and maybe I'll say hello. Like, he's nasty to everybody except for Jack Lemmon. That's the only guy in this book that he likes is Jack Lemmon.
Really?
Yeah. Jack Lemmon comes over to the table and he says, pull up a chair. But it's really funny. I mean, he really lays into everybody. I mean, he doesn't like anybody. He doesn't like Kaplan. He doesn't like, name him. And he doesn't, I mean, he Rita Hayworth, I mean, he, you know, because he was married to her. I mean,
he kind of liked her.
He doesn't badmouth her at all. I mean, this is after the, like, 30 years later. But I mean, he doesn't say a negative word about her. He's good about her. Jack, I mean, he likes maybe three people out of the 100 people that get mentioned in this book. I mean, he doesn't like Leslie Howard. I mean, he doesn't like anybody.
Wow. Maybe he was in his sort of bitter, grumpy old man years by the time he got to that. I think he disappointed himself and life disappointed, because he peaked real early. He peaked with his first movie, and it was really kind of, life was a never-ending tale of disappointment and disillusion after that. So by the time he gets to the, what was it, the 80s? That
yeah, it's 80, I think it's 83 to 85. It's like right before he died, like the last two years of his life.
He's had like 40 years of disappointment behind him at that point.
Yeah. So, I mean, he starts out with, he's got Citizen Kane, which is supposedly the greatest movie ever. His last movie is Transformers the Movie. I mean, God. Disappointment, I don't think even begins to cover it.
But, I mean, if you're looking, I mean, some people say they read this book in one sitting. And it's, I mean, it's a transcript of these two guys talking, Wells and his friend, who was secretly recording him. But Wells knew he was being recorded. He just said, just don't let me know when I am or not, and you can do it. Because if I'm being recorded, if I know I'm being recorded, I'm not going to be, you know, my real self. And I mean, he's like, almost like a college professor version of Archie Bunker. What's that?
I can see how that could be. Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't have a lot of good things to say about the Italians or the Jews or the. I mean, he like gives it to everybody, and you're just reading this like, this is crazy. I mean, this guy said this stuff. I mean, it's really, I mean, but it's interesting, and I mean, it's funny. I mean, the book is funny. People say, oh, I read this book in one sitting. It's draining. I'd read two or three chapters at a time and be like, I can't read any more of this because it's too much. But it's really funny.
Well, Ben, we're at an hour, almost an hour 25 here.
Okay.
And you've been very generous with our time, Martin. So I do want to ask you, I see the Peter Pan behind you there.
Oh.
Is that Wendy and I always forget the other two names.
Michael and John.
Thank you. But that's awesome. I like that. I just wanted you to show our viewers. Wait, let me get you on full screen here. There you go. So that's pretty impressive, because those look really good.
And, well, my husband and I run a Walt Disney memorabilia store, and so I'm currently surrounded by every Disney character you can possibly shake a stick at, which kind of helps if I'm sort of trying to choose colors or just general creativity. So this is where I write my stories at the store. We have a little store. It's mainly online, but we have an actual physical store. So I'm surrounded by creativity all day, every day.
Yeah. Where is your store? Just to give people the address in case they ever want to go there. If I don't know if it's even open right now.
No, we're not. It's a small store, so I get a bit if more than one person walks in. So technically, it's not. It's called Fantasies Come True, and we're in Studio City, so we're about 5 minutes from Universal Studios. Yeah.
Okay. That's awesome. Yeah, we really appreciate your time on this. It was a lot of fun talking to you, I got to say.
Thank you.
Don't hang up yet, because we'll talk to you for a minute after he signs off.
Okay.
Yep. So I want to give you a chance, please. Plug everything you have.
Well, my main website is martinturnbull.com. I'm also on Pinterest, Facebook, and Twitter, where I post a vintage photograph of LA every day. I post a vintage photo, and I try and keep it to 500 words, a little explanation about sort of time and place and what, and maybe something interesting. So if you follow me in any of those platforms, you'll get a daily photo from me.
I saw today.
The Kodachrome. I love Kodachrome. That treasure chest of photos of Hollywood. It's 70s and 80s, which is a bit late for me, but I'll take Kodachrome anytime. So you never know. Honestly, you never know what's going to pop up next.
Sure.
Yeah.
And yeah. We want to send everybody to your site to at least read the first book, maybe buy his other books. I'm really interested now, and I'm going to try to slice up some time here in between my full time day job and trying to run this website.
So, let me say something about the book to get people that may be leery. The great thing about the book, one of the great things about the book, is it reads real brisk, and it has a lot of short chapters. So you don't have to feel like, geez, I got to read another, my Kindle. I read it on my Kindle. So, I mean, it says this chapter's 3 minutes, this chapter's 7 minutes. And then towards the end, there's chapters that are 20 minutes, 22 minutes, stuff like that. But most of the chapters, I mean, I think that there's about 40 chapters in this book, and most of them are 7 minutes or less, I think, to read. At least they were for me.
Yeah. And that was intentional, because I wanted to give people an idea of the dynamism of the place. It's like, there was a lot happening and a lot going on, and things were changing all the time. So I think life was very, I mean, we live at a brisk pace now. Well, not during COVID, of course, but I think back then, like I was saying, things were changing. We just got sound. We just got color. We perfected color. Now we've got Citizen Kane, and we've got the Search for Scarlet. Things were changing all the time. So I think life was very, we didn't sit on our couch at night and watch TV. We got dressed up, and we went to the Coconut Grove, and we went to Ciro's, and after a long day at the studio. So life was like that. And I think it was a conscious decision for me to make shorter chapters, because I think that's kind of what life was like. It was bada bing, bada boom.
Yeah, Netflix really ruined stuff. So do you have, is this particular series finished, and do you have more coming, or do you just have a new series you're wanting to do?
The series is finished. It's a 9-book series, and that came out a couple of years ago.
Okay.
I then wrote a novel about Alan Azimova, the person who started the Garden of Allah. She had a very interesting time in the early 20s when she was making a version of Salome. So that's called Chasing Salome. I followed that up with a book about Irving Thalberg in the early days of MGM. So that follows his life from the MGM merger in 24 for about 12 years. And right now I'm working on the first book of a trilogy set at Warner Brothers during World War II.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
So maybe once I get deeper into that, we can come back together and we can talk about that, because Hollywood during the war was a place where things really changed, and pace really changed, and life really changed. And after the war, everything changed. So
sure.
A great many of their stars went to war. I know Jimmy Stewart retired a brigadier general.
Yeah. I just did an article this week about the stars that were big stars that
that's left right.
World War II.
I bookmarked that just this morning because I did a bit of research and went, oh, now that's right up my alley. Yes, I'll be bookmarking that and reading that later.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to find these articles that we're mentioning in passing, if you go to the lastmovieoutpost.com, on the homepage, there's a button that says Columns, a drop-down box that says Columns. If you click on that, it'll say Hollywood History. And if you just click on the Hollywood History, it'll take you to, 30-something articles right now. I mean, I do one or two every week. And I do the ones that people seem to like the most are the ones about houses. So I did Elizabeth Taylor's houses. I did Elvis Presley. I did the Roxbury Drive. I did Clark Gable and Carol Lombard. You know, those are some of the ones that I've done. And everybody seems to really like those. But I've done a lot of different topics that we've sort of glanced over in this discussion. But I don't want to monopolize anybody's time going over that. If you're interested in that kind of thing, check it out.
Yep. And you can come into the YouTube channel and watch my ridiculously long videos about Popeye. So
I will.
And Flash Gordon, he did a great interview with a lady that did a documentary on Flash Gordon.
Really?
Why don't you talk about that?
I did my video on Flash Gordon, just kind of going through the history of it, which was a Dino De Laurentiis film, and Dino De Laurentiis was not exactly the most stable of individuals, and all the stuff that went into making that. Well, some of that I pulled a few minutes here and there, which I credited from a documentary called Life After Flash, where she went in, she interviewed Sam Jones and kind of followed him on what his life and the turns that he had taken when he thought he was going to be a much bigger star than he ended up becoming. And so she reached out to me, kind of like you did, and we spoke about it, and she was just lovely. Her name's Lisa Downs, and she was just really lovely. And it was interesting. And she's done another one called Life After the Navigator. I don't know if you remember Flight of the Navigator back in the 80s. That poor kid going into adulthood had a really rough time, and his that documentary was like it was like a gut punch. It really was. So, but yeah, I recommend everybody go to it. Everybody get to Martin's site, read his books, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
So thank you very much for watching Outposters, and we'll hopefully see you on the next video.